Today is October 24th. It's our third class in the Melton Gesher program at Men and Women in the Talmud. And today's subject are stories about sexual temptation. This is interesting. So we're going to read a number of stories. I don't know how many of them we'll see. And we'll be developing similar themes. I hope you'll find this interesting and edifying. So first, we're beginning with a story from the Babylonian Talmud Tractate Shabbat, page 127b. And the subject here is the mitzvah that's called Hevedan Chol Adam Lechavzchut. Judge every person favorably. There are verses in the book of Leviticus which the rabbis interpret as a commandment to judge others favorably. Always give them benefit of the doubt. And here at the end of Tractate Shabbat, there are three stories about judging favorably. I brought two of them because they relate to our subject of men and women in the Talmud, specifically sexual temptation. Here we go. Our rabbis taught. And as you might remember, that introduction our rabbis taught means we're learning a braita, which means material from the time of the Mishnah, which means from before the year 200 of the Common Era. Over 1,800 years ago, our rabbis taught. It happened that a certain pious man, a chassid, ransomed an Israelite maiden from captivity. So the scenario is that it happened sometimes that the goyim attacked the Jewish town and took a few people captive, and then they said, "We'll give them back if you pay ransom." And what happened is that the Jews would get together, collect money, and send someone with the money to go ransom the captives. It was not an uncommon theme. And so they sent this man with the money. It's all we know is before the year 200. That's all we know from this story. We don't know where, we don't know really when. So he went to ransom the one woman from captivity. And since it was a distance from wherever he or she lived, he had her then take her with him on the way going back, and apparently had to stay over at a certain inn. At the inn, he made her lie at his feet. Mm. Now, that's not clear to me what it means. Does it mean that everyone slept in one big room and that he told her to lie with him? Or does it mean that everyone had separate rooms and he put her in his room? One of those two.
Was it from the book of Ruth?
We have a similar expression right in the book of Ruth, that she lied down at his feet.
We don't know what that meant either, I guess.
It seems more or less literally she lied down where he was lying down.
Sure.
On the morrow, when he woke up, he went down, had a ritual bath, when he went to the mikveh. He purified himself. And as we know, one goes to the mikveh in many cases. But among the cases where one is required to go to the mikveh is after sexual intercourse. So he goes to the mikveh in the morning and learned with his disciples. So apparently that means that he went on this mission with his students, but when they slept at night, he slept with her. By her, I mean in the room, apparently, but his disciples weren't there. They were in a different room. Said he to them, in the morning, when he studied with them, "When I made her lie at my feet, of what did you suspect me? We thought, perhaps there's a disciple among us whose character is not clearly known to our master." So the students answered, "We figured that you made her sleep with you in your room because you didn't want her sleeping in the open quarters where other men were present, because this is one of the disciples that you suspected. You didn't know his character, you suspected he might try some hanky-panky. When I descended and had a ritual bath and went to the mikveh, of what did you suspect me?" He asked his students. "We thought perhaps through the fatigue of the journey, the master was visited by a nocturnal pollution, by some similar mission at night, and therefore you had to go to the mikveh. Because indeed, there's a custom of going to the mikveh after any type of seminal emission. By the temple service," which is a way of swearing, "he got up and declared, 'Wow!' Exclaimed he to them, 'It was even so.'" That's exactly what happened. "And just as you judged me favorably, so may the omnipresent judge you favorably." you should be judged favorably by God, just like you judged me favorably. Let's read another story, and then we'll go back and talk about this one. Our rabbis taught. The scholars were once in need of something from a noble woman, where all the great men of Rome were to be found. Now, that's not clear at all. The scholars were in need of something. That probably means some type of political favor. And they had to go to someone high up in government. And the someone high up in government was a certain noblewoman. And all the great men of Rome were to be found among her. Now, that has a double meaning. It means that she was in the circles of government and all the noblemen were among her friends. But also may mean that she, this noblewoman, was the head of a brothel and all the great men of Rome were found by her.
That's more likely. In that year, those years, there wasn't anybody up high.
But it has to mean at least that she has some government influence, or else it wouldn't be clear why the rabbis needed her favor from her. And
services all the important government people.
And there she has some influence under the table. Right. Could be. Said they, that is the scholars among themselves, the rabbi said, "Who will go?" "I will go," replied Rabbi Yeshua. Now Rabbi Yeshua, well again, it's not clear. Rabbi Yeshua is in Eretz Yisrael, is in the land of Israel. And it says all the great men of Rome were found among this woman. So it probably means he has to get on a boat and travel to Rome.
Right.
This is a serious undertaking of a number of months. But he goes. So Rabbi Yeshua and his disciples went. He took his students with him.
Thank you. Sorry.
When he reached the door of her house, he removed his tefillin at a distance of 4 cubits. Now this was the time when rabbis wore their tefillin all day and all day. Mm-hmm. Not during the nighttime, not on Shabbat, but 6 days a week they wore tefillin. Mm-hmm. Not like today, we wear them only for 5 minutes or an hour in the morning during davening.
Why is it that we change the...
That's a whole other can of kosher
worms.
But they wore their tefillin all day. When he reached the door of her house, he removed his tefillin at a distance of 4 cubits. Entered and shut the door in front of them. He didn't let his students come in to the brothel / mansion with him. After he came out of the house, he descended, had a ritual bath, he went to the mikveh, and learnt with his disciples. Said he to them, "When I removed my tefillin, of what did you suspect me?" "We thought," our master reasons, "let not sacred words enter a place of uncleanliness." Which, calling it a place of uncleanliness, again, lends us to understand that we're talking about a house of ill repute. Now, of course, another reason to take them off would be to have sex. But they said it was probably that you were thinking, "Let not sacred words enter a place of uncleanliness." "When I shut the door, of what did you suspect me?" You know, why did I go in alone and not let you guys come with me? "We thought perhaps he has to discuss an affair of state with her." Right? He went on a mission here to get some type of favor for the rabbis. "When I descended and had a ritual bath, what did you suspect me?" "I went to the mikveh. What did you suspect?" "We thought perhaps some spittle spurted from her mouth upon the rabbi's garments." And indeed, there's a law that the spittle of this woman transmits ritual impurity, and you have to go to the mikveh afterwards. There are many reasons why one would go to the mikveh. "By the temple service," he exclaimed, that's a way to swear, "wow, that's amazing what you guys just said. It was even so, that was the truth. And just as you judge me favorably, so may the omnipresent judge you favorably." So now, the subject here again is not men and women, it's not sexuality. The subject is the mitzvah of judging favorably. And we see here the exemplary behavior of these students who are able to judge their teacher favorably, and we should take that as a lesson, of course. But, reading between the lines, we can ascertain some very interesting things. So first of all, the rabbi knows that it's very likely that the students are going to suspect him of sexual impropriety. That's clear from the story.
Well, Sounds reasonable, if that's why he visits her.
It sounds reasonable. Mm-hmm. So that means two things. That means that indeed the students could very well suspect him, and it means that he knows that the students may very well suspect him.
But it doesn't say the scholars would need something from the woman, and so what? It doesn't discuss what they needed from her.
Again, it's probably some type of political favor, right? At this point, the land of Israel is ruled by the Romans, mm-hmm. and the Roman governor is, let's say, persecuting economically. Something's not right. So the rabbis send a delegation to Rome to try and ask the emperor to do something about the behavior of the governor, to try and relax some laws, some persecution, some economic discrimination. So this tells us something about the atmosphere and the culture at the time that the rabbis are living, whenever this story took place, that it wouldn't have been out of the ordinary for a Jew, and even a rabbi, to be suspected of, in the second case, entering a Roman brothel, and in the first case, of having relations with an Israelite maiden who he ransomed. It wouldn't be out of the ordinary for such a thing to be suspected, which means it wouldn't be out of the ordinary for such a thing to really happen. Even though in the first case, of course, we're talking about a rabbi who ransoms someone who's been taken captive, it could very well happen, meaning that it does happen, that he first rapes her before he brings her back to her family. And it's kind of out of the ordinary, extremely out of the ordinary and exemplary, that the students don't think that that's what the rabbi did. It's like, wow, you didn't suspect me. That's really great. You did a great deed here. So all I'm trying to prove is that the culture that we are now examining is certainly no less sexually charged than the world we're living in today. No less and perhaps more. But think today. Let's say today that the United Nations sent a special envoy to the pirates off the African coast to ransom a certain woman who had been taken captive. Would we suspect that the special envoy of having sex with her before he brings her back to her family? I don't know if we would. We probably wouldn't. I think we probably wouldn't. But here, it looks like that we could have suspected the rabbi of doing that. So that means that on a certain level, we're talking about a culture that's perhaps even more sexually charged than the one we're living in today. Right? Okay? That's all I wanted to show in the story, as an introduction to the other stories we're about to see. So now we're from Tractate Kiddushin. Certain redeemed captive women came to Nahardai. Nahardai is a city in Babylonia where there was a large
academy,
a large Jewish community. And what it means, again, is that these women were taken captive by some non-Jews, and the Jewish community ransomed them. They sent someone with the money, and now on the way, bringing these women back from where they were taken captive to their community, they stay overnight in Nahardai. They were taken to the house of Rav Amram the Pious, Rav Avram HaChassid. Now, why are they taken to his house? Because he's beyond reproach. He's going to protect them from any type of rape or sexual licentiousness that town people might think to do to them. And the ladder was removed from under them. We have a case in which there's a loft in the houses, and the way to get up to the loft is with a ladder. And they took the ladder away so to keep these women chaste, to keep them away from any mobs that might come. And I'm thinking of the stories of Sodom in the Torah. Right?
And in the incident in the book of Judges.
In the book of Judges. As one passed by, a light fell upon the loft, which means that these women, we don't know how many there are, they're milling around in the loft, they're walking, and as one of them walked near the edge of the loft, a beam of light fell upon her so that she could be seen from below. Another interpretation is that she was so beautiful, she caused a beam of light to shine below. But whatever it is, the next line says, thereupon Rav Amram seized the ladder, which 10 men could not raise, and he alone set it up and proceeded to ascend. In other words, it's a story in which Rav Amram the pious, who's supposed to be guarding these women, suddenly is set upon by a fit of sexual passion, and he's about to go up the ladder to do what he's going to do. And he is so taken, and he's so smitten by sexual passion that he's able to pick up a ladder that it couldn't be raised by 10 men. He has superhuman energy at this moment. When he had gone halfway up the ladder, he stayed his feet and cried out. Now, in the Hebrew, it says that he stayed his feet. In other words, he took his 2 feet and he spread them so that each of his feet is pushing against the uprights of the ladder. He's physically preventing himself from going higher. In other words, you have to picture here an inner turmoil in which he is fighting against his, in Hebrew, his Yetzer Hara, his evil impulse. And he's really in turmoil. And as he's going up the ladder with this great sexual passion, he manages to push his feet against the ladder so he can't walk any higher, but he's trying to walk, but he's not trying to walk. He's trying to stay himself, and he is in turmoil. And he cried out, a fire at Rav Amram's. He cries out, a fire, a fire! Everyone come and put out the fire. Which, of course, is a strong symbolic metaphor. He's saying, there's a fire in my heart, and I can't put it out. Come and put the fire out. And, of course, he's hoping that the townspeople will come and stop him for what he's about to do, because he can't restrain himself. The rabbis came, right? The whole village got up. Where's the fire? They brought buckets of water to put out the fire, right? And they saw that he's on the ladder. They understood what was happening. And the rabbis reproved him. We have shamed you. You know, shame on you. What's happening here? You're supposed to be Rav Amram the pious. What are you doing? He said to them, better that you shame Amram in this world than that you be ashamed of him in the next. He then adjured it, and the reference is, he spoke to his Yetzer Hara, right, to go forth from him, and it issued from him in the shape of a fiery column, which again is a symbol. It's fire, and it's a phallic symbol, and he sees himself as being rid of the fire of sexual passion. Said he to it, he spoke to his Yetzer Hara, see, you are fire and I'm flesh, yet I'm stronger than you. Because ultimately, it was a difficult battle, but he won, right? He won the battle against his Yetzer Hara. Okay, so what is this story saying? What are the values behind this story? Anyone have anything to open the discussion? Anything, what do you learn from this story that you didn't know beforehand?
Good to get help, even though you realize you may be shaming yourself in order not to do a greater
shame. Absolutely, absolutely, yeah. Right? Absolutely, true. Good point. What else?
That even great rabbi scholars can be tempted.
Even great rabbis can be tempted, right? You could have said to yourself, you could have thought that this is the last story in the world the rabbis will put in the Talmud because it doesn't reflect so nicely on them, right? But that's not the case. The story is in the Talmud. And the first thing it's telling us is that despite the fact that Rav Amram was a scholar, and despite the fact he's known as the pious one, he also, even he, is prone to sexual temptation. And he was able to pick up a ladder that 10 men couldn't pick up because the fire in his heart was so strong. So the rabbis are saying that anyone... Are you enjoying this? That anyone, even a great scholar, can be prone to temptation.
Maybe it also says that even the great scholars need to have
right,
to still
right.
There.
And very good point. Yeah. And that to overcome, you need help. You have to ask for help. And of course, the corollary of that is that it's possible to overcome. So there's like two poles to this story, that anyone can succumb to sexual passion. You're never immune, even if you're a great scholar. On the other hand, you can fight against great passion if you ask for the proper help and if you have the proper inner fortitude. But it's a real, real battle. Which means, of course, that we're not going to scoff or make fun of those who suffer from sexual passion and succumb. We now understand that it can happen to anyone. Rabbi Meir used to scoff at transgressors. Next story. Which means that Rabbi Meir, he really didn't understand how all these men succumb to sexual immorality, to sexual impropriety.
Was this Rabbi Meir,
the famous Rabbi Meir,
the
disciple of Elisha ben Abuya, the husband of Bruria?
Bruria, right. Yeah.
Right? He used to scoff at transgressors.
So why isn't that a peculiar way to equate a woman with Satan here?
I didn't read it yet.
Okay.
Wait, but then we'll talk about that. So Rabbi Meir didn't really identify with, didn't understand, didn't have any pity for those people who can't control themselves. One day, Satan appeared to him in the guise of a woman on the opposite bank of the river. So Jim says, why does it portray a woman as Satan?
No, why is Satan as a woman?
To tempt him.
But that means a woman is Satan.
No, it doesn't.
Why?
Now, first let me just say that we might ask ourselves, what do you mean Satan? What does that mean in Jewish terms? We're obviously not talking about what you find in Christian theology about a devil that looks red and has a tail and has a pitchfork, right? But the Gemara says that Satan and Yetzer Hara are the same thing. The evil impulse personified.
Can take any form.
The evil impulse wanted to get him.
He had the pole.
Right? And here, the evil impulse appeared to him in the guise of a woman on the opposite bank of the river. And obviously a very beautiful woman. It doesn't say how she was dressed, but the purpose is to seduce him. The purpose is to seduce him. As there was no ferry, he seized the rope and proceeded across. And Rashi explains that you have this plank bridge, and then above the plank bridge is a rope. You have to hold on to the rope in order to walk across the bridge. The bridge is swaying over the river. It's not an easy thing to cross the bridge. So he seized the rope and proceeded across.
Right.
When he had reached halfway along the rope, Satan let him go. In other words, the woman disappeared. Saying, had they not proclaimed in heaven, take heed of Rabbi Meir and his learning, I would have valued your life at 2 ma'az. In other words, nothing. 2 pennies. In other words, Satan is saying, I would have shown you, right? I would have caused you to transgress, but I heard a voice from heaven that said, take heed of Rabbi Meir and his learning. Let's read the next story, and then we'll go back and talk about them. The next story is the same as this one, except it's Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva used to scoff at transgressors. He had no understanding of those people who couldn't control themselves. One day, Satan appeared to him as a woman on the top of a palm tree. There she is, waving down at him, come up to the palm tree with me. Right? And again, she's very beautiful, and it doesn't say how she's dressed or she's not dressed. Grasping the tree, he went climbing up.
Right.
Rabbi Akiva starts climbing the tree to get to this woman, this prostitute at the top of the tree. But when he reached halfway up the tree, he let him go. The woman disappeared. Woman disappeared, saying, had they not proclaimed in heaven, take heed of Rabbi Akiva and his learning, I would have valued your life at 2 pennies. Nothing. And I would have shown you. So, what's going on here?
But you say, you describe Satan letting him go as saying that the woman disappeared.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
How do you reach that conclusion?
What else could it be?
Well, he could have dropped off the tree, or he could have fallen into the water when he left.
But that would indicate then, if she disappears, that does not imply any self-control on Rabbi Akiva's part.
It doesn't. Exactly, it doesn't. It doesn't. That's a very good point.
Or it could be a figment of his imagination.
It's yes, it is. It is a figment of his imagination.
Yeah.
But the way the story is phrased, again, it's hard to know. But the way the story is phrased, there is some type of outside force. It's the Yetzirah personified. But I think it's a very good point that Jim made, that these stories don't give any credit to Rabbi Meir or Rabbi Akiva.
Or Rabbi Meir, for that matter.
I said Rabbi Meir or Rabbi Akiva.
Both times, Satan disappears.
Right, they don't give credit, like in this case of Rav Amram. In that case, he controlled himself.
In both cases, Satan let him go.
Right. In these two stories, it's the opposite. The story is trying to show how these two great rabbis had no control of themselves. No control. And they're totally at the mercy of Yetzer Hara, of the evil impulse, of Satan. Now, I further want to point out, why did the Satan let them go? Because a voice came out of heaven, right, saying, let them go because of their learning. Now, let's think about that a minute.
He might have thought of his learning. He might have thought to himself of his learning. What did he learn from his learning? And which made him cognizant that he should what he should properly do.
I hear.
And so, in a sense, the Yetzer Hara left using his knowledge and appreciation of what he should do from all of the learning he had, he was able to master.
So listen to my response to Chip. My response to Chip is that what Chip just said is exactly what it doesn't say.
Doesn't say, okay.
No.
Right?
It does not say he made a decision, but it was saying that the decision was made for him.
Right. In other words, it could have said that Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Meir, because of their great learning, were able to summon the inner fortitude to overcome. That's exactly what it doesn't say. But I think it says the opposite.
It makes the impulse go away. Does it make the impulse go away?
It doesn't say that their learning did anything to directly save them. In other words, it doesn't say that being a Torah scholar can do anything to save you from Yetzer Hara. But it actually says the opposite. Despite the fact that they were great rabbis, they completely fell head over heels. And the only reason they were saved is because a voice came out of heaven and said, take heed of Rabbi Meir and his learning, which I think means that we have to give them a break, says the voice to the Satan. Otherwise, it will terribly embarrass the Torah. It will embarrass their learning. And everyone will say, if Torah scholars do such things, well, then how are we normal people supposed to overcome? But the idea is that the Torah learning in itself didn't save them, and it doesn't save them. Being a scholar is no guarantee against sexual passion and succumbing to the worst things. It doesn't help. And that's a very, very disappointing thing.
Who is strong? He who controls his passions.
We're going to get to those things, right?
But in both cases, the woman let him go. If the woman was in the guise of Satan, Satan was in the guise of a woman. So it was a woman who made the decision to say...
That's another good point.
Let him go.
Now, it's really giving us a sense...
Instead of using her guile to... how would you call it? To induce him or to the woman made the decision that you're not the man I want.
In other words, it gives you a sense that the rabbis feel themselves to be powerless
in front of a woman.
In front of sexual passion, which is personified by women. In other words, it's a sense, perhaps, of being drawn in by, I'm going to say here, Greco-Roman culture, and we're powerless.
And the Greco-Roman culture, using women and prostitutes, it was an accepted thing to do.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But in this case, a woman just went beyond, above and beyond that and said, he's a great scholar, therefore I'm not going to seduce him.
Yeah. But and of course, such miracles don't happen
every day,
all the time. So I think that the ultimate feeling we come out of these stories with is that although it's obviously proper to resist, but we can understand those who don't. The sexual licentiousness of the culture is just so powerful that even great rabbis can fall prey, and it's not their fault. And their learning doesn't help them.
Well, it doesn't follow through to the basic idea of sexual desire was put there for the purpose of having children. And if you have that sexual desire without the purpose of having children, then it's improper.
Yeah, but Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Meir are married rabbis. They have wives, right?
But they're
seduced. In any case, they're seduced. Now, of course, in the end, they didn't go through with it.
But not because of their own
strength. In the case of Rav Amram, that's different. He had the power to summon the community to help him overcome. Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Akiva, it looks like, had the Satan not had pity on them, they would have succumbed. Now, I'll just add, of course, that we see here that the Talmud is certainly willing to show our great heroes in less than perfect circumstances. It tells the truth, warts and all.
Isn't there a saying that the greater the person, the greater the...
We're about to get to that. Pretty good, Chip.
But just in keeping with what was just said, Judaism has rules for each partner to please the other beyond having children. So
you're right.
It's not a Jewish idea.
But this is outside of marriage.
Right. Well, that's a different story, but just what you were saying is that you have sex for children and then you're finished.
Well, yeah, he didn't mean that.
I misunderstood. That isn't a Jewish concept. Okay.
Yeah, but again, in these cases, marriage is not enough, and the lure of a prostitute or of a...
Okay,
is powerful, 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 even for these rabbis. So now we turn the page. You're right, but I.
And that's why Orthodoxy, very, very fanatic Orthodoxy. They're afraid of women, so they, because of their temptation.
Let's keep reading.
They don't have the willpower.
Well, but that was also always, they would always go to the Taberuk of the Orthodox. If you're outside the community, it's all right to do it. And that's why
we'll get to that in a minute also. Everything you're saying is on these sheets.
Okay, sorry, I haven't read the sheet. I'm more interested in looking at you two.
Okay, it's fine. So now we're looking at a passage from the Babylonian Talmud Tractate Kiddushin, page 39b to 48. We're picking up the middle of something, but it doesn't matter. As in the case of Rabbi Hanina Bar Papa, whom a certain matron urged to immorality. Now, what is a matron? A matron is a word for a powerful Roman aristocratic woman. But that might have, again, the connotations of the owner of a brothel, a woman who owns a brothel. So she urged him to morality. Meaning she's trying to cajole him and convince him and seduce him, either for herself or for one of her women. Now, did such things happen every day? I don't know. But the rabbis, at least in this culture here in the land of Israel, feel themselves as living in a culture that is trying to seduce them. Which again goes back to what one of you just said, about sometimes we read in the paper about the ultra-Orthodox having a sense that the culture is every minute trying to seduce them. The world is a dangerous place. There's temptations there that are very, very hard to resist. So he pronounced a certain magical formula whereupon his body was covered with boils and scabs. In other words, how did he manage to flee from this temptation? By making himself disgusting so that she wouldn't want him anymore. But she did something, he was healed. Right? So she did a magical kind of incantation, and he was healed. They're fighting each other with magic. So what is he going to do now? Now, why did he originally bring this disease upon himself? Because he felt that was the only way he could resist. He felt his willpower melting. And now, she has healed him, so what is he going to do? So he fled and hid himself in a bathhouse, which means an outhouse. And he said, no one's going to look for me here. She won't flee with me into the latrine. So he goes and hides in the latrine. In which when even two entered in the daytime, they would suffer harm. So this is part of the magical system of some of the rabbis of the Talmud, that there are demons and spirits in outhouses, in latrines. So he went to a place that he thought he could get away from her, but it was a very, very dangerous place. You can be eaten alive by the demons in the outhouse. And even if two people go in, all the more so, he went alone. He risked his life. He risked his life to flee from her. The next morning, the rabbis asked him, who guarded you? They saw him in the morning coming out of the latrine. He spent all night there. And they're amazed that he's alive. The demons didn't eat him alive. So they say, who guarded you? Said he to them, two imperial armor bearers guarded me all night. In other words, God sent me two angels to protect me. Otherwise, I wouldn't have survived. Again, it's not wouldn't have survived the woman. I wouldn't have survived the demons. Said they to him, perhaps you were tempted with immorality and successfully resisted? For it was taught, he who was tempted with immorality and successfully resists, a miracle is performed for him. We have a tradition that if you survive the outhouse at night, survive the demons, it must be because you had been tempted by immorality and you resisted and God did a miracle for you. Interesting story. So, the story certainly indicates a culture that is suffused with sexuality, that the rabbis feel themselves assaulted, and then it's really difficult to resist. All those around them are succumbing. In other words, the use of prostitution was pretty common.
I guess if you think of Yosef.
Okay, very good, very good.
He resisted. He was able to resist temptation, at least according to a plain reading of the text.
Yeah, he's absolutely a model in this type of stuff. In this case, Rabbi Chanina Bar Papa was able to resist, but he risked his life. And he only was saved by a miracle, as if to say, you need a miracle to resist. Mm-hmm. Right? Just like with the Rabbi Kiva story and the Rabbi Meir story, without special divine intervention, you're lost.
Sounds like paranoia to me. All these stories seem so
paranoia. Well, explain what you mean.
I mean, people writing this are afraid.
They're afraid, absolutely.
And they're totally paranoid about it.
But when we say paranoid, we usually mean a fear that's not rational.
Well, I don't think this is rational. I mean, do something to go to bed with her. Lots of beautiful women walk around and they don't get raped in the streets. It's crazy.
Okay, very good point.
I mean, you know, I mean, so easily tempted seems paranoid. By the writers, not the men, the writers. There's just so many examples of this that, and they take people like the most famous, and even they are tempted to prove that there's no.
Also, look at
I think that they are trying to portray, not about control, but they're trying to demonstrate how strong man's passion is, sexual passion.
Yeah.
And
then,
you know, I can buy that to a degree, but.
Yeah, if the rabbis.
By the time Rabbi Akiva was a rabbi, he was well into his 50s.
Okay, so let's remember.
Nonsense. That he's going to go swim across the river.
Okay, right. No, it's not about Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Meir. The story uses them.
I understand.
Right?
But
you're right. The story is really talking about the authors of the story.
Right.
And it's telling us, the authors are telling us, that sexual passion is alive, that it's a strong temptation, and that sometimes people succumb, and even the greatest people might succumb. So I wouldn't call it paranoid, because if they're writing it about themselves, then it's true. It's subjectively true. It's true that they feel themselves subjected to this onslaught of sexual passion. That's not paranoid, because it describes a true subjective experience. You might say that it's paranoid in the sense that it's not that the women are out to get the rabbis. It's rather the passion inside that's out to get the rabbis. But that passion is certainly fueled by a Greco-Roman culture that is suffused with sexuality. And like I said earlier, perhaps it's not that different than today. Perhaps even worse than today. And I think it's certainly noteworthy that rabbis don't say there's sexual passion out there, but the Torah gives you the strength to resist, period. No, the Torah doesn't give you the strength to resist. That's clear from here, right? That even the greatest rabbis suffer from the same conflicts and the same temptations that the simplest men suffer from. The rabbis are not immune, and the Torah is not an antidote, necessarily. That, to me, is an important statement. Were you about to say something, Jim?
No, I'm just saying, in our own common culture, we've seen such a dramatic change. And in the time in the 40s and 50s, on the movies and on TV and everything like that, to see a philosophy that you did not show people in bed to each other. But now, you see that on TV every night at this point in time.
Oh, we can turn it on.
Well, I know you can turn it on, but you can't get away from it.
Right.
You know, you've got to, the common culture now, as opposed to, you look at the old movies of the 40s and 50s and 60s where you had to have a plot. In the movies today, you have to have two things. You have to have people jumping out of cars and jumping from 10 stories. You have to have pictures of a man and woman in bed.
Yeah.
So evidently this is true human nature, and the teachings are trying to, and nobody is immune.
Nobody's immune.
Nobody's immune. It's out there, realize it, and as I get older, I realize how really that it has shaped the world's history. Mm-hmm. Because the station you have in life for a woman is who you marry, and the leadership that you can assume is if you have been chosen by a particular man.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that this is the story of history. And it continues as to station of life very much as always been, according to your status as somebody's wife or consort. But the really interesting thing is that I think that probably what this is showing us is that it's innate in human nature. And that these men are aware of how important it is to put it out there rather than to hide
cover it
under the table. And we're finding, I mean, with the Boy Scouts, you know, that it, and the churches, that it happened underground 150 years ago. And there are records of squelching it.
Mm-hmm.
So the maybe the nature isn't new. It's the fact of the expression of it. Mm-hmm. And it's the other things in the culture that is substituted what you're seeing on the movies. And it's part of the challenge of this world to continue to learn, study, think, and act not as a member of a crowd, but an individual.
Mm-hmm.
But even in this story, all women are treated only. The rabbis have their ability to scholars, but you don't see any of the women here treated as anything other than a sexual object.
That's true. Stories.
Well,
that's
it's a temptation, but that's what the men feel.
Well, but
I mean, as Jimmy Carter said, you know, I only thought about it. Well, evidently, there are a lot of people thinking about it, and perhaps the fact that we've had prostitutes from the beginning of time, the Jews had rules about how to use them and how to realize that when you capture a woman that you're not supposed to. Same thing, you know, goes on with the IDF. You're not supposed to, as you are supposed to, and that is the culture world that we're facing, as to knowledgeable or not knowledgeable. But you can't control, you're not a human being without having the passions, because the passion to do good I mean, those are emotions that are within you, and some people have them and some people don't.
But look at the dramatic change in the status of women during our generation, and that, you know, as you were saying.
Well, I'm well aware of it. I'm a woman that has been through all of that. But also within the individual families, the individual cultures, you know, the stereotype wasn't 100%, because if a father, as Rabbi Akiva, according to the stories, if a father had these feelings for his daughters and didn't have sons, then he really, in a lot of the laws in Judaism, or protect the woman.
Okay, we're going to get to all this.
Right.
And let's go back to the stories.
Yeah,
all the themes that we're hearing are coming up in the next stories. So now, bless ye the Lord, ye messengers of his, ye mighty in strength that fulfill his word, hearkening unto the voice of his Lord. That's the verse from Psalms. Okay? There are people who are mighty in strength who fulfill God's word. Says the Talmud, this refers to Rabbi Tzadok and his companions. Rabbi Tzadok was known to be a very, very righteous man. He's the one that has the strength to fulfill God's word. And of course, strength is indicative here. It's hinting the strength to overcome passion.
Self-control.
Rabbi Tzadok was summoned by a certain matron to immorality, just like the previous case. Said he to her, my heart is faint and I am unable. Is there aught to eat? So apparently he's trying to find some type of excuse to get out of her clutches. And he says, I'm too weak, I have to eat something first. She answered him, there is non-kosher food. I have food, but it's not kosher. He said to her, what does it matter? He who does this eats that. Not clear to how to interpret that. I'll give you one possible interpretation. He has totally melted. He feels himself to already have succumbed. He is so disappointed with himself that he just didn't flee and said no, but he just gave excuses as if he's about to succumb to her, that he says to her, you know what? It's unkosher. I'll eat it anyway, because anyone who does this, what I'm about to do, can eat that. He has completely lost his sense of who he is, any self-control, and he is depressed, despondent at himself that he's about to submit, but he feels himself submitting against his will. She then fired the oven and was placing the forbidden meat there and to give him a meal first. When he ascended and sat in it, he went into the oven.
In the oven?
He went into the oven to kill himself.
Mm-hmm. No.
For a moment he found the energy to not to resist, because he feels as if he already succumbed. He's so disappointed with himself that he goes to commit suicide. He's going to sit in the oven, which she just heated up. Said she to him, what's the meaning of this? What are you doing? You know, I'm just making a meal so we can go to bed together, and you're going into the oven to kill yourself. What's happening? And what he said is, he who does this falls into that. The same type of phrase he used earlier. But now he means, anyone who does what I'm about to do deserves to be burnt up in a fiery furnace of hell. Had I known that it was so heinous, said she, I would not have tormented you. End of the story. We don't know how it ended. But it looks like she's saying, okay, forget about it. If it's so terrible in your eyes, I'll let you off the hook.
Big oven.
A big oven. Yeah, no, they did have very big ovens.
Yeah.
No, they did have big ovens. They have stories in which they, or the whole community came and put their pots and their bread in one oven.
He sat on it.
He sat in it.
Uh-huh.
And he went into the oven. So notice again, this story doesn't paint our rabbis in beautiful colors. It shows them warts and all. He was weak and he would have succumbed. And he didn't succumb only because she let him go, actually. And it's very ironic, because it refers, the Talmud uses the verse to refer to Rabbi Tzadok, that he's mighty in strength. He wasn't mighty in strength at all. He was lucky. But he was lucky. Another story. Rav Kahana was selling baskets. And the implication is that he was forced to spend a lot of time with women. In the market, it's basically women who sell things. But he was so poor that he had no money and he had no profession. He had to sell baskets in the market. when a certain matron made immoral demands of him. The same story again. This Roman brothel owner, important woman, comes and starts seducing him. Said he to her, "I will first adorn myself." He doesn't say no. He says, "Wait a second, I have to get dressed nicely. I have to be prepared for the moment. I have to put on perfume." So it looks like he had a moment of weakness. He thereupon ascended and hurled himself from the roof towards earth. He committed suicide. But Elijah came and caught him. The prophet Eliyahu came and saved his life. So again, the same theme as earlier. It's a miracle, the same as we spoke Rabbi Chanina Bar Papa. It's a miracle that saves. Just like with Rabbi Kiva and Rabbi Meir, right? The woman, they heard a voice from heaven and said, "Save Rabbi Meir because of his learning. You have troubled me to come 400 parsings." He reproved him. Eliyahu said, "Why did you make me come all this way and save your life? Can't you control yourself?" "What caused me to do it," he retorted, "is it not poverty? Because I'm so poor, I have to be in the market and be around all these women." So he gave him a bag full of dinare. So Eliyahu gave him some money so he doesn't have to go to the market. End of the story. So what do we see from the story? Again, the rabbis are inundated by the culture of immorality, and even Rabbi Kana would have succumbed had it not been for a miracle. He would have succumbed or committed suicide. But there, he's not a role model as far as a strong, independent human being who can just say no when you have to say no. So a lot of stories we're seeing here are talking about the fact that it's almost impossible to say no. That almost everyone will succumb unless a miracle is done, even great rabbis. And then we get to a story that was mentioned earlier.
Can we do the last, if we have time? The last one on the page, most interesting one.
If we don't do it today, we'll get to it next time.
All right.
Next week. Rabbi Abahu said on Rabbi Chanina's authority, "Better had a man secretly transgress than publicly profane God's name. For it is said," and it brings a verse from the book of Ezekiel, "As for you, O house of Israel, thus saith the Lord God, go ye serve everyone his idol. And hereafter also, if ye will not hearken unto me, but my holy name shall ye not profane." So even if you serve idols, but don't do it in public, don't profane God's name. Rabbi Eli the elder said, "If a man sees that his evil desire is conquering him, let him go to a place where he is unknown, don black and cover himself with black, and do as his heart desires." It's talking about prostitution. "But let him not publicly profane God's name." Don't, if you live in Tel Aviv, don't do it in Tel Aviv. Go someplace else.
Go to Temple Rock.
Go to where?
Well, like the Orthodox in Jerusalem, they had a place called Tel Baruch.
Oh, Tel Baruch. Right, Tel, that's Baruch, where it's known as a place of prostitution.
Which was basically
red light district.
Well, it was, yes.
You know, I don't know where Jim gets his information from.
He's a Charlie.
No, what you do is, it was a very good restaurant on Tel Baruch that you would go to, and as you drove through there, you would see the prostitutes and the Orthodox men coming and getting out in the bushes, moving and everything like that.
You saw this yourself?
Yes, you saw it yourself.
Okay, look, I don't know.
We didn't see the action. We were just,
I'm just reading from 1,700 years ago. So anyway, that's what Rabbi Eli said. And of course, we're certainly taken aback that Rabbi Eli didn't say, "Control yourself." Rabbi Eli assumed that there's going to be a situation, at least sometimes, when the person cannot control himself. And in that case, Rabbi Eli says, at least do it in the least damaging fashion, not where everyone can see you. But the Talmud objects. I mean, this is something to object to. The Talmud objects, and it says, "But that is not so. It can't be what you just said, for we learned. He was careless of his master's honor. It were well for him that he not have come into the world." Now, what does this refer to? Rabbi said to one who gazes at the rainbow. Rav Yosef said to one who transgresses secretly. In other words, what we're saying now is transgressing secretly is even worse than doing it in public. Because what you're saying is, it's if God doesn't see me. You're actually making a terrible theological statement by transgressing in secret. And you should rather not have been born than transgress in secret. So how did Rabbi Eli said what he said? And the Talmud's answer is, there's no difficulty. The one means where he can subdue his evil desires, the other where he cannot. When the Talmud said that you should rather not have come into the world, you shouldn't be born, rather than transgress secretly, that's someone who's able to overcome, but decides to transgress. Whereas Rabbi Eli, when he said what he said, was referring to someone who cannot, who absolutely cannot subdue his evil inclination. That's an amazing statement, that the Talmud is willing to say that there's such a case that a man cannot, just cannot control himself, and there's nothing he can do. So let him go transgress in secret and just don't do it in public. So again, this isn't license to transgress, but it's making a very, very pessimistic, but perhaps you'd say very realistic, statement about human culture and human society. That sexual temptation in some cultures at some time is just so strong, there's going to be people who are going to succumb, and you cannot blame them. They couldn't have done otherwise.
So that actually tells us there's an exception to every rule, but it also says don't judge.
It certainly says don't judge. Remember, earlier, so the rabbis used to scoff, and then they were taught their lesson. Right? Don't judge. That absolutely says don't scoff, don't judge. But what do you say? There's an exception. Exception to
which rule? Exception to every rule. Those that cannot resist. So that would be carried over to any kind of transgression that the rabbis did not have. I mean, they looked for a way to live in the world where they were, not in favor of these things, but saying when you can't do anything else.
Yeah, I'm not sure it's any transgression. It looks like specifically sexuality is what we're talking about. That's where there's a passion that sometimes cannot be controlled.
But there are a lot of other passions that would restrict. I mean,
but they're not talking about other passions.
What the law is based on is there's a window.
there's a window.
And from that window that you can build a case. So, I mean, that's what I see.
Okay, but again, I think they're talking specifically about this.
We're trying to teach rather than daydream of something that wasn't there.
Right. They're in the real world.
They're in the real world, and that's what I take it for.
And just let me add that we learn that even if you transgress, you have to minimize the transgression, right? Even if you feel yourself forced to transgress.
Don't shame others just because you shame yourself.
Well, don't shame God. Do it in private.
That's between you and God, but it's...
Oh, no, the idea is that
you have
God's name
over God's judgment.
No, the idea is that God's name is disgraced when a person transgresses in public. Yes. Someone who's supposed to be representing God. So therefore do it in private and minimize the damage. So there's more stories.
Maybe tomorrow you'll be able to resist.
Maybe tomorrow, yeah. Hopefully tomorrow. Okay, I see we have more to do for next week.
Thank you, Rabbi.
You're welcome.
Tomorrow morning?